Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 17. I'm going to cover the entire chapter in this audio, verses 1 through 16. I'm going to call it Water from the Rock at Rephidim and Victory over Amalek. Our context is this. In a previous chapter, we see the children of Israel on the Exodus. They've crossed the Red Sea. And of course, where that is, nobody knows exactly where it is, but they've ended up probably somewhere on the northeastern side of the Suez Gulf, at least according to a lot of traditional maps. And they have gone from Mara, where God made the bitter water sweet. They went to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palm trees. Then they went south into the desert of Sin, which was just to the south and to the west of Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. Now they're going to go through the desert of Sin in stages. This is where we are now. So we start with Exodus 17, verses 1 through 2. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" Now this wilderness of Sin, its name is not related to sin. The Israelites were sinning, all right? They quarreled, they grumbled, and so forth, but sin has nothing to do with their sin. It's just a coincidence of language that it's called that. The stages that are mentioned here in our verse are not given names, but we can see the names of two places they stopped at on the way through the wilderness of Sin in Numbers 33, 12 through 14. They journeyed from the wilderness of Sin and camped at Dophka. They journeyed from Dophka and camped at Alush. These are just two places in the desert. They journeyed from Alush and camped at Rephidim. Now, it was there that the people had no water to drink. So that's where we are now at Rephidim. If you look at the map, Rephidim is south of the desert of Sin, and it's to the west of Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai. It's very close. Now, of course, Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai, some people say they're the same two places. Some people say they're two different peaks of the same mountain range. I don't know, but somewhere there in the south central portion of the Sinai Desert is our famous Mount Sinai, and right to the west of there is Rephidim. So Rephidim is a stone's throw from Mount Sinai. There's some interesting things happen at Rephidim, as we'll see here. The first thing that happened was there was no water to drink, and the people started quarreling with Moses and grumbling again and testing the Lord. Now, by testing God, they failed the test that the Lord had given them. Exodus 16:4, the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you." This is the manna and the quail that happened earlier, right before they entered the desert of Sin. They grumbled, but God nonetheless had grace and mercy on them and gave them quail and manna to eat. Now in Exodus 16:4, God said, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instructions." So that incident of manna in the desert was a test from God. And it's all right for God to test his people, but is it all right for the people to test God? No. That's like your algebra teacher gives you a test to see whether you know algebra, and then you as a student says, "Well, I'm going to test you, algebra teacher. Let's see if you know any algebra." You just don't do that. Well, the people of God shouldn't have done that, but they did. They obviously show they don't believe in God. This is after they've miraculously crossed the Red Sea and watched the Egyptian armies drown. They've miraculously seen the bitter waters of Mara turn sweet. They've miraculously seen the manna provided in the desert and the quail provided in the afternoons, and they're still griping because they say, "We don't have any water." Now, they were in the desert at Rephidim with no water at the direct command of the Lord. It says that right here in verse 1. They journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord. God put them there. He put them there. He knew what he was doing. The people didn't like the hard circumstances, and they started complaining. Of course, this gives rise to many, many, many applications here, because isn't that what happens to us all the time? We get put in hard places by the Lord, and the first thing we do is start grumbling and testing the Lord. We want to see, God, are you really God? Do you really care for us? Do you really want to take care of us? So they quarrel with Moses. Now, this command that they travel to Rephidim, it could have come from a voice from the cloud. Adam Clark disagrees with that. It could have been a night vision, either to Moses or Aaron. Clark disagrees with that. But Clark says it was the movement of the cloud. Gill suggests that also. And I think that's probably true. God commanded them to move by moving the pillar of cloud, because that's how the Israelites knew where to go, by following that pillar of cloud, the Shekinah glory in the daytime, which was a fire at night. Now, the people at Rephidim are quarreling with Moses. They're testing the Lord. But just to give them a little bit of due, it's real easy to condemn the Israelites, but would you have done the same thing if you were there? If you or I were there, would we have done the same thing? It must be remembered they were in terrible straits. They were in a situation that called for a lot of faith, and they had not had a lot of faith developed in them yet, even though they had seen a lot of miraculous stuff. But God graciously kept building faith in them through various tests. He kept showing them over and over again, I am the Lord, I'm going to take care of you. So in verses 3 and 4 in Exodus 17, we read this, But the people thirsted there for water, thirsted at Rephidim, and they grumbled against Moses and said, Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me. Now notice the people are acting like Moses and Aaron had brought them there to deliberately kill them. It would have been one thing if they had said, Now, Moses, why did you bring us up from Egypt that we might die here in the desert? Well, that's one thing. But to say, why did you bring us here to kill us? They acted like Moses was some kind of seditious fiend who had in his mind the desire to murder Israelites, which is ridiculous. It's stupid. So Moses is not happy, of course. He cried out to the Lord, What shall I do to this people? Notice not what shall I do for this people, but what shall I do to this people? A little more, they will stone me. Now you see the alienation from the leader and the people. Moses calls them this people, not what shall I do for my people, or what shall I do for your people? It's what shall I do to this people? Adam Clark says they were grumbling, the Israelites, because they were in a state of great mental degradation owing to their long and oppressive vassalage, and they had no firmness of character. Well, the Israelites, all the way through the Exodus, grumbled when they face a crisis. We see this in the last chapter, verse 2, Exodus 16. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. That was at the bitter waters of Marah, if I recall. Exodus 17:3, But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses. That's where we are now. Numbers 14:2, All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, and would that we had died in this wilderness. Numbers 16:11, Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. But as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him? Grumble, grumble, grumble. Numbers 16:41, But on the next day all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. Now in reality, they weren't just grumbling against Moses and Aaron, they were grumbling against Yahweh. Exodus 16:8 says this, Moses said, This will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings, which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. So people who grumble against godly leadership, here's your application. They're not really grumbling against their leadership. They're grumbling against God themselves. Now, this is not to say that you should never raise objections to your leadership. Your leadership should be plural for one thing, and it should be humble for another, and should be willing to listen to complaints of the flock. I'm not talking about that legitimate, constructive complaints, but just grumbling because things aren't going your way. Well, there's no excuse for that. There might be a fine line between grumbling and constructive criticism, but that line needs to be found and not crossed. Moses realizes things are so bad that the people might actually stone him and kill him. Now, I don't know if Moses thought they would really do that or whether he was just getting carried away and exaggerating a little bit, but he is really distressed. But notice that he doesn't show any resentment or vindictive imprecation on the people, as Jameson Fawcett Brown put it. He calls them this people, again, showing alienation from them. He doesn't say my people or your people, God. Isaiah 6:9 says this, He said, Go and tell this people, some other examples of prophets who are fed up with the people and who dissociate themselves from the people. Go and tell this people. Haggai 1:2, Thus says the Lord of hosts, this people says, not my people, but this people. We go now to Exodus chapter 15, verses 5 through 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, Is the Lord among us or not? Now Moses takes that same staff which he struck the Nile. He's always using that staff. Think of Charlton Heston there with the staff up in the air in that great movie, The Ten Commandments. So Moses is supposed to go before the people and take some of the elders. That's because the whole nation, several million of them, a couple of million, could not see the water coming from the rock at Rephidim. So he took the elders of Israel, the leaders, so because they could see. And God says in verse 6, "Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb." God is a God. He is a spirit. He doesn't have feet. So how does he stand? Well, that's metaphorical. The cloud was there before the rock. And water, and Moses shall strike the rock and water will come out of it. This, of course, is a classic type of Christ. Christ is the rock. He was struck by being nailed on the cross. And out of him came rivers of living water, just like water came out of that rock at Rephidim. We see this in 1 Corinthians 10:4. Paul says this, "And all drink the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ." John 7:37, "Now on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." So we see Christ as a rock. We see Christ is providing water to thirsty people. And likewise at Rephidim, the rock was struck even as Christ was struck on the cross, and rivers of living water came out of that rock, just as rivers of living water come from Jesus. Now the water that came out of the rock at Rephidim must have been a large quantity. It had to supply water for 2.5 million people for over a year as they were camped down there before they headed north of Sinai. That's a lot of water. Now Moses here did all this, this striking of the rock at Rephidim, in his old stomping grounds, because remember, he kept sheep for Jethro, his father-in-law of Midian. Midian was the lands to the east of the Gulf of Aqaba, but also there on the Mount Sinai Peninsula, right around Mount Horeb. And Moses was there for a long time being a shepherd for Jethro. So he's in familiar grounds here where he strikes that rock. Now, he named the place where the rock was struck Massah and Meribah, gave it two names. Massah means testing, because the people tested the Lord there. Is God really with us or not? We're going to see God, testing God. And Meribah means grumbling or quarreling, because they quarreled with Moses. That's a great place name, isn't it? Testing and grumbling. Where do you live? I live at Testing and Grumbling. But it's a very evocative name, really. We go now to verse 8 and verse 9. Exodus 17. "Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Now Amalek is the first pagan tribe to fight the Israelites, and it's a very famous pagan tribe because they were fighting the Israelites for a long, long time. So I'm going to give you Eastern's Illustrated Dictionary's account of the Amalekites, a tribe that dwelt in Arabia Petraea. Now, the Romans divided the desert back then into three parts. If you'll think of where Saudi Arabia is now, if you go down to the southwestern corner where Yemen is, that was called Arabia Felix. Felix means fertile in Latin, and unfortunately, because of translation problems, Felix also means happy, so a lot of times it's called Arabia Happy, Arabia, in French, Arabia Arurs, for example. But anyway, that's Arabia Felix in the southwestern corner. Then the center part of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula is Arabia Magna or Arabia Deserta. And then if you go north of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and get up toward Jordan and get up right there at the Sinai Peninsula, the Gulf of Aqaba, you got Jordan going west from Jordan to Gulf of Aqaba to the Mount Sinai Peninsula to the Gulf of Suez to Egypt, and then all the way over to the northeastern delta of Egypt, that's Arabia Petraea. And if you go north from the Sinai Peninsula until you get to the Dead Sea, that's still Arabia Petraea. And then if you go up a little bit on the eastern side of the Jordan River, Perea, that's also Arabia Petraea. So those are the classical names for these areas. And the Amalekites dwelt in Arabia Petraea, which is between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea, basically. And so, and also south of there in the Sinai Peninsula, and that's where the Israelites were there. The Israelites were in the Amalekites' home territory. They were probably a tribe that migrated from the shores of the Persian Gulf, Easton's continues, and settled in Arabia. They dwelt in the land of the south from Havilah until thou comest to Shur. Havilah is somewhere south of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and shores the desert that borders the northeastern delta of the Nile River. So Numbers tells us that they basically dwelt in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. They were a pastoral and hence a nomadic race. Their kings bore the hereditary name of Agag. They attempted to stop the Israelites when they marched to their territory, attacked them at Rephidim, that's where we are now. They afterwards attacked the Israelites at Hormah. We'll get to that in Numbers 14. We read of them subsequently as in league with the Moabites, that's in Judges chapter 3, and the Midianites, Judges chapter 6. Saul finally desolated their territory and destroyed their power. That's about 1,000 or so B.C. And David recovered booty from them, 1 Samuel 30. In the Babylonian inscriptions, they are called Sut in those of Egyptian Sittiu, and the Amarna tablets include them under the general name of Kabati, or plunderers. Now, they went and fought against Israel. Why? Well, their name Kabati fits pretty good. They were plundering the Israelites. The Israelites were loaded with wealth, which they had allegedly plundered from the Egyptians. Actually, the Egyptians gave it to them voluntarily. But the Israelites were military vulnerable, not vulnerably. They were militarily vulnerable now because they were just recently slaves. They had no military experience. They had to protect their women and children and baggage train. And doggone if the Amalekites didn't attack them from the rear as they were going south. The Amalekites came from the north, hit them from the rear where their women and children and baggage was. Now, notice that the Israelites were proceeding away from their territory, not towards it. So self-defense was not the motive of the Amalekites. The Amalekites attacked in a cowardly way. They attacked the rear, and they attacked the women and children. Real chivalrous, was it not? Moses records in Deuteronomy 25:18 how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear. The he is the Amalekites. The Amalekites attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, yet he did not fear God. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this, quote, the Amalekites were a nomadic tribe making an irregular attack on a multitude probably not better trained than themselves, and for such a conflict, the low hills and open country around this wadi would afford ample space. So, first big military test for the Israelites here. Joshua is going to be their military man. Of course, that's the same Joshua that ends up taking the Israelites across the Jordan River. Moses says to Joshua, go out, that means away from the camp, and fight Amalek on the plain, I guess, before Mount Horeb. And Moses, along with Hur and Aaron, are going to stand up on a hill and watch all this. He's going to have that famous staff, the same staff he used to bring the plagues on Egypt. He's going to have that staff in his hand. Now, this Joshua that's going to go out and fight the Amalekites, his original name was Hoshea, son of Nun. We read that in Numbers 13:16. These are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So Moses changed Joshua's name from Hoshea to Joshua. Now, Hoshea means salvation, according to the NIV Study Bible. And Joshua means the Lord saves, according to the NIV Study Bible. So Moses just slightly changed his name from salvation to the Lord saves. The Greek form of Joshua is Jesus, of course, which means salvation, because Jesus is our salvation. So Joshua's name, not only his name, but his life as a deliverer, make him the perfect type of Christ. Joshua was from the powerful tribe of Ephraim. We read that in Numbers 13:8. Now, Joshua's military prowess served him well. He's going to win this battle with the Amalekites. His military prowess served him well 40 years later when he conquered Canaan, as the NIV Study Bible says, when he was conquered Canaan as Moses' successor. Now, his loyalty to Moses suited him well to be Moses' right-hand man. We read in Exodus 24:13-14, so Moses arose with Joshua his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. This is the same Aaron and Hur that are on Mount Rephidim holding up Moses' arm, which we're going to read about in just a minute. But Moses left Aaron and Hur with the people while he took Joshua with him up to talk to God. So Joshua's very close to Moses. He's Moses' right-hand man. We read in Exodus 33:11, thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. So Joshua was with Moses in Moses' tent all the time. He wouldn't leave there because he's Moses' right-hand man. This is the first place, incidentally, that Joshua's mentioned in the scriptures. So Moses and Aaron and Hur are up on the hill. Joshua's out on the plain fighting. The hill, of course, is Mount Horeb, which is either near Mount Sinai or is Mount Sinai. So Joshua went out in verse 9 away from the camp. The women and children were there in the camp, as Gil says, and Joshua goes away from the camp so as not to fight where the women and children are. We go to Exodus 17:10. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Now, who is this Hur? He is perhaps, not definitely, but perhaps the same as another Hur mentioned. This other Hur was the son of Caleb and the grandfather of Bezalel. Caleb, of course, was one of the two spies who went into the promised land and said that, hey, everything's cool, big grapes. And Bezalel's famous because he was the artisan that built the tabernacle, that helped build the tabernacle, guided by the Holy Spirit. So that Hur is mentioned in 1 Chronicles 2 as the son of Caleb and the grandfather of Bezalel. Gil says that Hur was most likely the husband of Miriam. Now, how in the world Gil knows that, I don't know. But at any rate, he was one of Moses' trusted leaders. We don't know too much about him. Now, why did Moses take Hur and Aaron to the top of the hill? Well, the first reason was so he could see the battle. Another reason probably was so that the people of Israel could see Moses with his rod lifted up. Because he's standing up there, lifts that rod up, and the people say, yes, let's fight. Our leader is stretching forth his staff to God. We go to Exodus 17, verses 11 through 13. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him. The they is Aaron and Hur. They took a stone and put it under him, under Moses, and Moses sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Round one to the Israelites. Now, here's a question. Why would Moses hold his hand up? Well, it could be a symbol of his appeal to God for help and an enablement, as the NIV Study Bible, John Gill and Adam Clark all say. Got my hands up to God. I'm appealing to God. Help me. Another reason why he might have held his hands up is to encourage the Israelites to fight. Now, here's another interesting question is, why was it that when Moses' hands went down, the Israelites started to lose? And when his hands went up, the Israelites started to win. Well, Gil offers a natural explanation for it. The Israelites were encouraged when they saw the staff up and then discouraged when they couldn't see it. I find that hard to believe. I've always taken this as a supernatural thing. God caused the battle to go whichever way the staff was. And he did that in order to maintain the symbolism of the upraised staff in supplication to God. In other words, the object lesson for us is, if you want God to win your battles, you better keep holding your hands up to God in supplication. You better ask him for victory or you ain't going to get it. There's another object lesson here. Moses' arms got heavy. The battle was long. He was tired. The battle seemed like it was never going to stop. He couldn't hold his hands up anymore. He had to have help. Leaders can't do it all by themselves. They have to have help. All leaders, military leaders, political leaders, they all have helps. They don't really usually make it into the history books. Maybe they do in footnotes, maybe, but every leader's got them. Exodus 17:14. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Now, why did Moses need to recite as he wrote this sentiment in the book that God's going to blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven? Why does he need to tell Joseph that, Joshua that, as he writes? Well, first of all, that would mean that Joshua would be able to back up what Moses was going to write down. In case anybody doubted it, in case anybody didn't have the book to read it, Joshua could say, hey, this is what he told me. Amalek's going to be wiped out. In other words, it was just another witness. It also indicates that Moses was thinking of Joshua as his successor, because the battle of the Amalekites was going to go on for a while, even beyond the time that Moses was living. After Moses died, they still had to deal with the Amalekites. And so it was written down, and it was put in Joshua's head, hey, you got to block these guys out. This book that Moses wrote it in, I wonder that he later used that book in writing this passage in Exodus as a memory aid. I don't know. This is the first mention of writing that's on record in the scriptures. This is the first writing that's mentioned. Now, the Amalekites were going to be blotted out from under heaven, their memory. When was this fulfilled? Well, Saul partially fulfilled it, 1 Samuel 15:8. He, Saul, captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. Unfortunately, he didn't kill the king, Agag. He killed all the Amalekites, but he started. He was supposed to kill the king, but didn't. Remember, he was rebuked for Samuel for not doing it. But he did kill the Amalekites. And David more completely finished the job. First Samuel, or I say finished the job, continued with the job of stomping out the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 13:17, David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So 400 Amalekites escaped David. John Gill says a Targum shows that Mordecai and Esther finished the job by wiping out the rest of them. I don't know the Targum. John Gill is well educated in Jewish lore. I'm sure he knows what he's talking about. But at any rate, in Mordecai and Esther, we're talking about the time of Xerxes. Esther was married to Xerxes. Xerxes is 400-something B.C., so that was a long time later. Moses is now at 1450 or so B.C. So we're talking about 1,000 years before they were finally blotted out. We go to Exodus 17:15-16. Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And he said, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." Like I said, 1,000 years or so. "The Lord is my banner." Why would an altar be named "The Lord is my banner" by Moses? Why would he do that? Well, the name of the altar can be translated as, quote, "The Lord is my miracle," meaning that it was a miracle to beat the Amalekites. Or it could be referred to the Moses' rod being lifted up over the battle as if it were a banner. The NIV Study Bible and John Gill suggest that. Or it could be that a banner is a flag representing the government under which the soldiers fight, and so it's just a general reference to the fact that the Israelites were fighting under the banner of Yahweh, under the administration of Yahweh. "The Lord is my banner. Yahweh is my banner. I'm fighting under Yahweh." So it might not have a particular reference to the staff, but just a general reference to God being in charge. The altar was built on Mount Horeb. Now, Moses says the Lord has said we will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. You might think, isn't that a little harsh? One little battle here, which the Amalekites lost, and we're going to still be fighting there from generation to generation? Well, we need to remember that the Amalekites, they were not nice people. As Jameson Fawcett Brown put it, they had a deep and implacable vengeance that they meditated against Israel. We read in Psalm 83:4. "They have said," they is referring to certain pagan nations, including the Amalekites, "they have said, come and let us wipe them out," wipe the Israelites out as a nation, "that the name of Israel be remembered no more." That's in Psalm 83:4. Three verses later in 83:7, we see who the "they" is that said they were going to wipe out Israel. Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. That's who's going to wipe out the Israelites. Gebal is the city of Byblos, the famous city of Byblos on the Lebanon coast. Ammon, of course, is the nation that is on the eastern side of the Dead Sea and further up a little bit beyond that, the northern part of the Dead Sea. Present-day Jordan, if you will. And Philistia, of course, is southwestern Israel on the coast of the Mediterranean. Famous opponents of Israel. At least all of them are famous. Gebal might not be. And Tyre, of course, is also famous. Now, notice these people calling it, these nations, according to Psalm 83, were dedicated to wiping out Israel as a nation. Well, you know, if you're going to be that hard-hearted about it, you deserve to get wiped out yourself. So I don't have any sympathy for the Amalekites. I'm not a wussy-puss submerging church evangelical, the ones that go around saying that Jesus is a jihadi Jesus. Notice that Moses says in verse 16, "The Lord has sworn," a sworn, that means he's taking an oath on himself. There's nobody else higher than he can swear. "We're going to fight Amalek until Amalek is doomed," basically. There's some alternate readings here for this swearing. NIV says, Moses said, "For hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord." And that makes it not Jesus, not God swearing, but the people of Israel swearing, "God's going to fight Amalek from generation to generation." That doesn't make it quite as strong. NIV translation has a note that translates, they give an alternate translation, or "because a hand was against the throne of the Lord, there will be war from generation to generation." In other words, since the Amalekites lifted up their hand against the throne of God, they had war on their heads from generation to generation. Well, however you translate it, doesn't make any difference. I think it's better just to take it the NASB way. The Lord has sworn, we're going to fight the Amalekites forever till they're gone. And that's what happened. Ladies and gentlemen, we're now finished with Exodus chapter 17. The first victory over the pagan enemies of the Israelites has now been accomplished. And we are now prepared to go to Exodus 18, verses 1 through 27. And we will listen to Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, give him some good advice. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.